Association and IndieBirth.com. No material on this podcast should be considered medical advice. Birth is not a medical event.
Welcome to IndieBirth's series of podcasts here on iTunes, Taking Back Birth. Hi.
Hi.
I'm here today with a very special guest and a really awesome story that she/we wanted to share with the world. I have Amantha here with me today. And before she gives a little intro, I just wanted to add in that a couple of listeners had written in lately and wanted to hear birth stories that were more outside of the box, just since we talk about a lot of those concepts and philosophy here on this podcast. And I thought that was a great idea, talking to women that had beautiful births, but maybe had to work a little bit harder for them in some ways, or make choices or consider medical care or treatment at different points, since that can be a very real part of pregnancy. And it doesn't mean that people don't have options.
Sorry.
No. So we have a mother of six here, in case you couldn't tell. That's Mr. Number Six right there.
He's
six
gonna
for six in the boys department.
Yes.
Yeah, he should totally hang out and tell his part of the story too. Hi, Lonnie. So big.
Yes. He's a good baby.
I bet.
My favorite birth story. Don't tell the others.
So how about a little bit of background, Amantha, for people that are, you know, getting settled here and want to hear your birth story? You have so much good story to tell before the birth even happened. So just go ahead.
So as you mentioned, I'm a mom of six. I've had all six of my boys, I thought as naturally as possible. I know now that that's not necessarily true. But I had my first son at the ripe age of 19, and I was induced for all five of my boys before Lonnie in the hospital with an OBGYN Pitocin drip in the hospital bed. And I love all their birth stories. They just weren't really conducted by me until Lonnie's. The reasons for my inductions kind of varied. The first one was because I was overdue, and the doctor decided that she didn't want me to be overdue, and so she scared me into thinking that I needed to have my baby in order for us both to be safe. And then after that, my inductions were with minus one that I needed to be induced for because I had HELLP syndrome. They were because of my high blood pressure, which for two out of three, it was my high blood pressure that was high from the beginning. It wasn't anything new to that pregnancy. And then the one that I was sick for, the HELLP syndrome one, it was new to that pregnancy. So I kind of had a variation of reasons to be induced, but really the same thing occurred in my fourth and my fifth son, leading up to why I knew I didn't want to be induced with my sixth.
Right. So with the five of them, or I guess the four of them then, was the blood pressure ever like discussed with you as part of other issues, or was it just purely like protocol? Like it's this number and we're going to do this. Like what was your experience with that?
Well, it started out actually with the third baby that I had was the one that I had HELLP syndrome with. And I was told from the get-go while being induced with him that if I had any more children, I would be considered high risk.
I was
told right away. I was even told by some nurses not to have any more children because of the birth. So going into my fourth pregnancy, I was a little on edge, knowing that I was automatically going to be high risk. And I knew that I had to be cautious, but starting out, I was hypertensive. I mean, there was just no other way of putting it. And that was like 140s over 80s.
Right. So, yeah. And a little background for those of you that don't know, HELLP syndrome is a pretty serious pregnancy complication. It can be really hard to detect. It's kind of like a relation to preeclampsia, but different. But, you know, I think almost everyone would agree that a woman that is truly diagnosed with HELLP is pretty sick usually. And, you know, but whether or not that makes that woman high risk for the rest of her, you know, obstetrical life, I think is up for debate. And I think you're definitely proof that that is not true. Yes. Second, I just wanted to share on your behalf, and you can say what you want to say, that you have extensive medical training. You're a nurse. You're very like familiar with, you know, your body and labs and a lot more than maybe your average woman would be, truthfully.
Yeah, I definitely was familiar with the medical side of things. I'm huge on research and clinical trials, and I know that those are not flawless, that they can also be very biased all the time. but I went into my fourth, fifth, and sixth pregnancy knowing my risk and knowing my health, basically.
Right. And so you didn't develop HELLP syndrome with 4 or 5, or obviously. So not again, right?
I did not. Mm-hmm. No. And I mean, I can hypothesize all day about why I developed it with that third one. I do think that there was a nutritional component. But that's all guesswork. Mm-hmm. The bottom line, 1 out of 6, and I don't think that made my risk any higher.
Right. Yeah. And again, for those that don't know, I think many people on the midwifery side of things, at least, would agree that there is a nutritional component often to hypertensive disorders, and then also HELLP and preeclampsia, but that there also is a fair percentage of cases that, you know, no one understands and can't really make any sense of. So for you, being in that position, having had HELLP, you didn't get it again with the next two, but then getting pregnant the sixth time, that's when we met. And I know you were seeking out your options for home birth. And, you know, how did that look and feel with your history and, you know, what you were looking for?
So I was looking for somebody that wasn't going to scare me. That was the biggest thing. I knew with my fifth that I was induced as a perfectly healthy 39-weeker, and that I very well could have carried him 2-3 more weeks, no problem. But every appointment I went to, I was left feeling scared and guilty. So I knew that I had to start out with someone that was never going to do that. I interviewed a local midwife that delivers babies all over the area that I live in, and she seemed very nice. But she also, in that first appointment when I was like, I don't know, 9-10 weeks pregnant, mentioned natural ways to induce me if I went overdue. And I instantly knew that was not going to happen. Like I wasn't going to continue with somebody that was going to already talk about how she was going to intervene with my pregnancy. Right. It wasn't going the way she wanted it to.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny. I was looking at the Arizona rules and regs the other day for a presentation that we're working on, because I had to refresh my memory as far as like what prohibited care is And I'm pretty sure you would have fallen outside of that anyway. So, you know, if you had made it as far as the birth, that would have been a miracle from that perspective anyway. But it's so fascinating because that's how it is in a lot of places, right? Whether they're midwives or doctors. And it's like, what is that based on? Like, you know, this whole hypertension discussion, which is huge, but then it's really like fear of, you know, preeclampsia and some other things that are confused with the issue, I think. So I don't know. I can say from my perspective that it was refreshing to meet someone who was so in charge of what they wanted and their health. And, you know, again, not that it was super easy, like you had things come up. But to have experienced that, I guess, having walked it 5 times prior, you know, you knew your body pretty well. And high blood pressure reading for you didn't mean that you wanted to look at, you know, super serious options, which isn't like everybody. Most people don't pick those things apart.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm a total, in my practice as a nurse and with my family, everybody doesn't fit in the same box. You know, everybody's medical history is different. Everybody's medical outcomes can be different. We don't all need to try and fit in the same medical risk and outcome box as each other, because I think that's where we start to come into some complications.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, treating everyone like that number makes it so that women can't even choose, and then they're scared to choose, which you had already experienced. Exactly. So with this 6th pregnancy then, so we started working together. What were your thoughts on like how this might be different, or things you were trying, you know, to maybe influence the outcome with from the beginning? Like, how was it all so different?
So from the beginning, I did research and spoke with you about following a high protein diet. So as soon as my stomach would allow me to eat much protein after that first trimester, and probably even starting into the second trimester, I might have started a little late on the protein intake. That was a game changer for me, was the eating the high protein diet. I would venture to say I wish that I had practiced it before ever becoming pregnant, because it's a huge learning curve to make your body eat that much protein. But I was able to accomplish that, and that was a game changer for me. So much so that I decided that my body was capable of doing anything I wanted it to do while growing a human being, which maybe isn't the case. Wasn't the case in my situation. So I just decided I was going to head off my pregnancy doing nothing but following the high protein diet. I got baseline labs with a physician's assistant at my primary care office. He was perfectly happy to help me decide what labs I needed and to follow with that component of my prenatal care. And I was just going to stay pregnant, eating my high protein diet, and working crazy hours without a problem. That was the plan.
Yeah. I mean, eating well is so important, and it's so cool you got to experience that. And like, you were so committed to doing that. And for those that don't know, you know, the Brewer pregnancy diet is kind of the midwifery recommendation. Again, not that all complications can be prevented, but so many can. And in your case, like you just said, you were working so much as a nurse overnight, which I think everybody would agree requires additional nutrition, additional protein, additional calories. So you were kind of, you know, it was kind of an uphill, not battle, but I mean, it was a lot of work for you, I know, to stay on top of that and really give your body what it needed with all the additional stress of life.
Right. And I've just always tackled a challenge as you know, rather than worrying about what could happen, I'm just going to make what I want to happen be the case. And so as far as working overnight and having all of these boys to take care of on my days off, it was just not going to be any big thing. I was just going to be pregnant as long as I needed to and work and not worry about it. And that worked out well for me for 31 weeks.
Right. Let's get to that part. Well, before we get to that part in the story, I remember thinking right before that we had just had a prenatal visit, and you know, I remember being at your house with your family and your husband saying, like, making a joke about, like, you'll just have to pick her up at work, you know, when she's in labor, because you're that dedicated, you're that, you know, committed. But it's hard work. And I think anybody listening could relate, whether it's your first pregnancy or your sixth, you know, the body can only take so much stress. And especially as you have increasing number of pregnancies, you know, sometimes it's harder on us than we think.
Oh, Lonnie's going to interrupt.
Okay.
That's okay.
Definitely. And my philosophy to get me through working so much was related to, you know, indigenous people that have to haul water while they're pregnant. They don't get to just stay and not haul water because they're pregnant. They have to do life. They have to do what they need to do. And so I decided that was, work was my form of having to haul the water for my family. And I was just going to do it regardless of how I felt. It didn't matter how tired or fatigued I was, I just had to do it, was the way that I had looked at it.
I did
make a lot of jokes and probably assumptions about how pregnant women should behave. And I think that I was wrong. I'm happy to admit that. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes you can't haul the water or you have bad outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're wrong. I think it's a humbling thing for any of us to realize that our body has limits. And I think that's a very humble thing to realize. So what happened? Let's share that part of the story. What, 31 weeks you said? Gosh, I thought it was earlier than that, but that makes sense. I mean, you would know best.
There was a small incident. So I think it was like 21, 22 weeks.
Right.
Worked three nights in a row, and then I had had I seriously couldn't even call it spotting. It was like one incidence of super pink bleeding, and I just figured that it was nothing. I actually thought that it was related to having sex rather than pushing my body too far with work. So I took it easy for a couple days after that, and then I had no other signs of problems from that point until 31 weeks, when I had a week of work where I think I added it up, and Marin's probably going to shudder. Over the course of like 5 days, I was going on working 60 hours.
Yeah.
that's hard for anybody to do, let alone somebody who's 31 weeks pregnant.
And on their feet, I mean, like, the stress of your job, I can't even imagine the physical stress that you're used to.
Right. So, after working these long stretches, having hardly any time off, I took a nap. And when I woke up and sat on the couch with my boys, after about 30 minutes, I felt a huge, gush, and it was a bunch of really dark blood. I was actively bleeding. There was no clots or anything like that that indicated to me that it was built up. I thought, my initial thinking was that I had a placenta previa because I hadn't had any ultrasound. So I didn't really know where my placenta lied. And I thought for sure that I had placenta previa, and I headed in to the hospital to see what was going on. But the baby was moving, so I knew he was safe. And I just prepared myself for maybe needing to sign up for a C-section later on in my pregnancy if it didn't move. But when I got to the hospital, I was told that I had an abruption, which wasn't what I was prepared for at all. That left a lot of questions for me and a lot of blame, basically. It was a blame game of, well, you should have known that this is what could happen when you work like you do. I was told I had uncontrolled hypertension, which isn't true. And then, of course, there was that whole no prenatal care piece that made the OBGYNs absolutely shudder at me.
Right.
Again, not true, but I wasn't fitting into their box, so it was making them uncomfortable. So I stayed in the hospital from Friday to Monday for at least 24 hours. The first 24 hours that I was there, I was on a magnesium drip because I was contracting probably every 3 to 5 minutes. Not that this matters, Marin and I know that now. I didn't feel like the contractions meant anything. That's my key phrase for contractions.
Well, your cervix wasn't changing, right?
No cervical changes. It didn't even feel like actual contractions. It was more of just like a irritation, you know. But it was every 3 to 5 minutes consistently. So I went ahead and went on a magnesium drip to calm those down, and then was put on a prescription to keep myself from contracting, which worked really well. And I thought that was weird that you don't want a woman that's 31 weeks pregnant contracting at all. But the ultrasound barely showed the ablation. In fact, the sonographer couldn't even really see the place where the ablation was, and it was hardly noticeable to the doctor that had read the ultrasound. So It wasn't a big ablation, and it literally, I bled for like 3 or 4 hours after that initial gush. It was just light bleeding, and then it was gone. So it was the most minor abruption that I think anybody could have.
Right, but scary nonetheless. I mean, I remember when you texted me the photos. I mean, you know, we're all conditioned to feel that way about blood anyway, especially in pregnancy. Nobody wants to see bleeding. Right. And, you know, not that it looked substantial, but it wasn't something anybody wanted to see.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't spotting.
Was not spotting. And I thought the same thing, just because, you know, you didn't report any pain with it or anything, that, you know, maybe a low-lying placenta was the most obvious reason. And, you know, that would have been another scenario. It was marginal, yeah, the abruption, just on the side of the placenta.
It was marginal, and I had repeat ultrasounds a couple weeks, and then about a month afterwards, and it showed I actually got into like a little bit of an argument with the sonographer in the follow-up ultrasound, because she said there's no way that I had an abruption at all.
Right.
She said there it was cervical bleeding, and I said, well, it was a lot of blood if it was cervical. And she goes, well, there's capillaries. And I go, no, that wasn't a capillary bleed. So, I mean, it was a little bit of a surprise to her that I had ever even been diagnosed as having an abruption.
Right. Yeah. I mean, best case scenario was something like that. Mm-hmm. For sure. Definitely. So I feel like you can have your, this is your story, but I feel like this is when it got really interesting, you know, to see like what would happen with the rest of your pregnancy and your choices and your path and, you know, what your body would ultimately decide with this little guy.
Yes. And, While I was in the hospital, I had basically convinced myself that I didn't have any other choice other than to deliver in the hospital. I knew that I should find an OB just to follow up with me in case that was the outcome. But in my mind, I was conditioned to think that there was no other option at that point, that I had to have this birth that I didn't want, and I had to let go of the fact that it was what I didn't want, and I needed to do what was safest for me and the baby. And looking back, there was nobody in the hospital that influenced me any other way.
Right.
I had one doctor that I really liked. He was really nice, but he told me that I will abrupt again. If not during my pregnancy, then in delivery.
And that's such an interesting thing. I mean, sorry to interrupt. It's just like there is no evidence that would point to that being true for someone. But of course, it was the most obvious thought. I know you were thinking of it. And of course, I was thinking of it. Neither of us wanted to, you know, be at home with an abruption. Of course not. But like, what was the real likelihood of that happening again? Nobody could really tell you.
No. And he said that to me without being able to back up any research. And I lose a lot of respect for anybody in the medical field that's willing to do that, to make a blanket statement without knowing where it's coming from. Unless it's your intuition, but then say it's your intuition, you know, and maybe I would respect that more than just in making an assumption. I was in this place of thinking that this terrible thing was going to happen to me again and put me and my baby's life at risk. And my safest option was a hospital delivery. But the weeks went on and nothing happened. I did stop working. I didn't work for at least a week after the initial abruption. And then when I went back to work, I was extremely light duty. I was off my feet. I never worked at night. I did desk work, thank goodness. One of my little part-time jobs accommodated a light-duty work for me so that I could, you know, make a little bit of money. It was definitely hard for me to say I'm not working at all, considering I'm the cash of the family. So being able to bring in enough money to get us through the next, you know, 4, 5, 6, ended up being 11 weeks was really nice.
Yeah.
And I continued with the OB, and he was really cool until I hit 40 weeks.
Yeah. And to back up a little, what were some of the other concerns? Like, I know you and I talked about them, but you know, for people that are kind of trying to like piece together parts of the story, like that the abruption was maybe tied to, you know, preeclampsia or some other conditions. Right. You're trying to rule out, you know, if there was anything bigger going on, because I know you and I were always agreed, I think, on all of this, but mostly that if you were sick or to become sick, then that would change the scenario. It wouldn't have been just, you know, a small episode of bleeding, it would have become something that was much bigger than that. So what are your thoughts on that? Or how did the doctor, like, were they thinking that? I don't remember them paying a whole lot of attention.
Well, they were saying it out loud.
That you had preeclampsia?
Well, that is why they thought I had this abruption. That was the direction I was going to go in.
Right.
And they found it really amazing because in the hospital, I had high protein in my 24-hour urine. And then in a 24-hour urine that I did about a week later, I did not have high protein. And then I think I did a total of 4 24-hour urines, and 3 out of 4 of them I had diagnosable preeclampsia protein levels. Like they were, oh, I might have frozen for a minute, sorry. I had protein levels that coupled with my high blood pressure, they could have called it preeclampsia.
Right. And that's, again, for people that are like learning this or new to this topic, how many ways are there, right, that different people will diagnose preeclampsia? Right. So I guess, you know, not that that's invalid, but you and I were on the same page that if you were well and feeling well and your labs, your other labs, your blood work wasn't showing signs of like, you know, liver compromise or HELLP syndrome, God forbid, that, you know, you knew your body best because you had been sick before with like a serious pregnancy disorder. So just to be clear about that, like, I guess you could have been labeled preeclamptic, but, you know, we need to be careful with these labels too for someone that was well. That would have been silly.
Yes. And I say with my hypertension, but really, I believe that, you know, the diagnostic criteria for preeclampsia now isn't just hypertension, it's an increase in blood pressure.
Hmm. Especially for someone that has pre-existing hypertension, it doesn't even make sense. Exactly. I mean, it's not fair that that's, you know, yep, part of the criteria. But the protein in the urine, other than the bleeding, which we, you know, we assumed that might have been a reason at one time, like, there wasn't really, nobody could have really said for you, right? Like,
I just decided, and again, this is me just making up decisions about my health because I can.
You can, it's your body.
I think that I just decided that I was eating a lot. I mean, I was eating like 120 grams of protein a day.
Right.
I think that my kidneys were tired and spilling protein. Mm-hmm. You know, my kidneys didn't show any compromise in my other lab work, but I don't know how else to explain that spilling of protein there at the end of my pregnancy because I wasn't retaining fluid. None of my other preeclampsia labs had budged at all from their baseline.
So. Right. Yeah. And that was really reassuring. I thought, again, you had the baselines. And then for people that kind of know, like midwifery/medical knowledge, you had expanded your blood volume, which I thought was really exciting because I remember, you know, having those thoughts too, like, okay, well, it doesn't have to be preeclampsia, but is this a constricted blood volume? You know, are we dealing with that on top of this, whatever you want to call it? And you weren't. Like, you had done a really great job of making that extra blood. And so these other factors, I don't think anybody could pinpoint, you know, what they meant or not.
And kind of relating to my background a little bit too, I've been working night shift for going on 8 years, which literally shortens my lifespan. Like, it's stressful on the body. So there's no doubt in my mind that I have underlying maybe vascular issues, which could explain all of my quote unquote complications. So.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, that is an enormous stress on the body, especially for years at a time. And, you know, we had talked about, they've done studies, right, with women that work overnight and even the incidence, I think, of preterm labor. So whatever, name your complication, but it's hard on the pregnant body, especially. So let's see, where were we? Following up with the doctor.
So I had the 24-hour urines. I did it was probably every 1 week to 10 days drawing lab work to, you know, make sure that there wasn't anything changing that looked preeclamptic. And then I had the two ultrasounds after my hospitalization. And those were to make sure that the baby was growing and check for any signs of abruption. And then that was the extent of my prenatal care. My blood pressure was great after I quit working night shift until like the very end. It started to have some scarier spikes. But I mean, I didn't have to do anything. I don't feel like I had to do anything crazy besides stop working overnight. I had to listen to what my body was telling me.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes the easiest and hardest thing to do is that.
Yes.
What about like the fear part of it though? Because I remember that you worked through a lot. And I mean, for a period of time, you know, we were still working together, but we didn't know, like I didn't know, no one knew how it would wind up or, you know, how I would maybe be supporting you or not, or like, where was your mind going for all those weeks about potentially having to like not have this home birth you had hoped for?
So probably for a good month after the abruption, I, in my mind, was convinced that I had to go through the hospital birth. And then as nothing else happened and I hit that, you know, full term threshold or that, you know, safe to deliver threshold and realizing that I could go into labor anytime and have a perfectly healthy baby, I decided that I was still seeing myself having a hard time with having the baby in the hospital and with not even getting a chance to labor at home. I was starting to hear that induction word again. And honestly, I think that I've researched so much both sides of induction as far as pro and cons that I'm a little scared of hospital inductions. That scared me more than the thought of abrupting at home. I know that sounds crazy, but the fear that I had in the back of my mind was of being induced in the hospital. It wasn't that I was going to have a complication if I stayed home.
Yeah.
So, from like 36 to 38 weeks, I had done a complete other turnaround and decided I was going to deliver at home unless something happened that showed that I was sick.
Right.
So I basically had to train myself into believing that I had never had an abruption. I had to let that go. I had to decide that that was over and healed and wasn't going to happen again.
Yeah.
And I had to concentrate on the staying well piece of my pregnancy rather than being afraid that I wasn't well.
Yeah. And that's a huge job, I would imagine. I mean, just checking in every day with yourself and, you know, knowing that you're truly the only one responsible for this. Like, there's no doctor, there's no one that could predict the future. And only you could say every day, you know, today I'm well, I'm still well, and this is my plan. I think that takes so much guts, especially when you were regularly interacting with the system that wanted to tell you you were sick and couldn't do it. Like, I don't know how you did it. Someday. I don't know how you like got out of that the fuzz that you did with that kind of interaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, luckily I'm able to take my own manual blood pressure and I'm very comfortable with manual blood pressure. So I always knew what my blood pressure was. And I started to see kind of patterns with my blood pressure. I realized that first thing in the morning, my blood pressure is higher than it is throughout the day. So I would try not to take it first thing in the morning because that would just get the whole fear cycle going. And if I did take it and it was high earlier in the day, I would let myself wait a couple hours and make sure it was coming down, because that was something for me and possibly for most women that are developing something like preeclampsia or HELLP syndrome. Is when I was that picture, my blood pressure did not come down. There was no amount of relaxation I could do that would make it come down.
Right.
So I knew that as long as my blood pressure was able to come down, that I was okay. It was really fun going to the doctor for checkups and the medical assistant checking my blood pressure and then doing all of her tricks to make sure to be able to report a smaller blood pressure to the doctor. I laugh, but it's not funny, because if I was sick, it would have been masked by this little medical assistant's ability to come up with a smaller blood pressure.
Right. And I mean, I did a podcast with a woman a couple of months ago who was just that, you know, she had full blown eclampsia. They totally missed the pre because nobody was paying attention to her readings. And it was her first baby and she didn't know what being sick felt like. So yeah, it's a real disconnect between all this diagnosis they're trying to put on people and then the lack of really good care. But I just want to say too that, you know, you taking like really full responsibility for that is one of the only ways I think situations like this work out and feel powerful for the woman. And I know, you know, myself as a midwife, I couldn't work with someone that didn't do that, but still fully appreciated that you were in charge of that. You took your blood pressure every day. We'd talk a lot and, you know, you'd relay the information, but I wasn't driving 2 hours every day to take your blood pressure to tell you something you didn't know. It was full awareness of living in your own body, which is ideal for everyone. Like I wish people would realize that you have that power. You don't have to be a nurse. You know, take responsibility for your health.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And just seeing other people in the healthcare system be completely blind to their ability to drive their own health, it makes me really sad that this happens to women on a regular basis for their pregnancies and for their babies and then for their children, that there's so much, I can't even say it's trust in the healthcare system, but it's mistrust of themselves. They don't trust their own ability to know what's best for themselves or their babies. And by default, they're trusting somebody who's been trained to treat everybody the same.
Right.
And that ended up for me having 5 hospital inductions because I felt like I had no other choice. Like I had to trust in the healthcare system, because if I didn't and something went wrong, I would be to blame. That's what I told myself over and over again before. And I told myself that for, you know, several weeks, even at the end of this pregnancy. You know, I had a really hard time deciphering if home birth was something that I wanted because I knew in my core that it was what needed to happen, or if I just didn't want to give up on the fantasy of delivering at home.
Right.
Yeah. I made the right decision, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really great point. I mean, and the answer isn't the same for everyone, for sure. There are people in situations that, you know, will choose to not be at home. And that's perfect for those people too. What about like listening to your baby? Did that happen in a different way this time, or how did you like try and figure out, you know, what he wanted or needed in this whole thing?
Well, I definitely, driving my own prenatal care and having to look inward to myself for choices rather than letting someone else make them for me, gave me a much stronger connection to my baby than I think that I ever had. Ultimately, I know that he was telling me that he didn't want to be born in the hospital, because anytime I would play out the scenario in my head, I could talk myself into just about every piece of having him in the hospital except having him in the hospital. I could do the labor and the delivery, and then the instant I would envision him being outside of my body in the hospital, I became anxious. It made me physically ill to think of that. And after now having a baby at home, I realized that there was a reason why it made me so anxious, because this was definitely a more natural way of bonding afterwards. So that was the biggest game changer for me, is that I just could not ease my own nerves about the thought of other people handling him moments after his birth.
Right. Right. And all for the potential fear of the what if, which is really what it came down to. Like, what if? And you don't live close to a hospital, so like, what if? But, you know, I mean, honestly, that goes for everyone, although your situation was more exaggerated. I mean, you had reason to probably worry and fear more than a lot of women do. But I think for a lot of us, like, there comes a point in pregnancy where, you know, you just have to face that reality that life is a chance, and, you know, there is no such thing as a risk-free situation. That's just not what we signed up for. So how do we do the best we can with what we know for ourselves to be true?
Well, and it was really ironic that I had the abruption, because to talk myself into being so far away from the hospital and delivering at home, I would tell myself earlier in the pregnancy that I'm safer at home than I am in the hospital, except for the case of an abruption or a prolapse. So I had to change my mind about that for sure. And like I said, I really just had to leave behind the fact that I had that abruption and let it go. I couldn't keep telling myself it was going to happen again. Because there was no reason to think it was going to happen again.
Right.
In my own mind.
Yeah. It was a warning for you to make, I think, other choices. And I know I talked to a bunch of midwives, you know, elder midwives in particular, and many of them had similar stories, you know, where of course everything went fine after, that there was no reason to fear, more than, you know, just like you taking care of yourself and you feeling good about the situation other than that.
Right.
So where do we leave off? Doctor care, winding up the pregnancy, wanting to be induced, of course. When did that start, the pressure to be induced?
So like right at 38 weeks, I was kind of forewarned by one of the OBGYNs that I was seeing that he was going to want to induce me at 39 weeks. And I let him know just as politely as he let me know that I was going to at least 40 weeks unless there was a complication. And I even let him know that I fully expected to.
You got muted. Wait, I can do it. Hold on. Can I unmute you? There you go.
I am. Sorry. I got muted for a moment. I told him that I expected to go past 40 weeks considering my other pregnancies. I was induced right around 40 weeks. I didn't go into spontaneous labor on my own. So after 39 weeks, he actually didn't even try to schedule me for an induction. It wasn't until I was 40 weeks that he said he wanted to schedule me to be induced. And I kind of passively agreed, like, all right, go ahead and schedule it. And I had just decided that it was me going to play the game. I was going to go ahead and I wasn't going to argue in the office. I wasn't going to get myself excited. So
right.
And let them schedule me for a elective induction at 40 weeks. And then I started to have a real discomfort with the fact that I was being scheduled for an elective induction. I felt like if there was a reason to induce me, why are we calling it elective? And the reason is because there was no reason to induce me.
Except they were still super focused on the blood pressure, right? And that was their reasoning. I remember asking you, like, what about like blood pressure medication? Like, why aren't these tools part of their toolbox? And your answer was just like, it's my history. They just see that and they want this baby out.
Right. And I mean, I don't even think that I would have taken the blood pressure medication had they prescribed it, just because of how up and down my blood pressure still was. Sure. But the difference in my blood pressure those last couple of weeks was when it would go high, it was going higher. And I knew what that did to me vascularly. So it was worrying me that because it was going so high that there could be some sort of complication, including a possible second abruption, you know. So the fear was starting to come into play those last couple weeks again.
Yeah, I remember many of those conversations. So when did we start to talk about just your options at home and how you were going to handle the rest of this pregnancy?
So it was probably right around the 40-week mark, because that's right when my blood pressure started going really high. And I think at 39 weeks was the time when I started doing things like drinking the raspberry leaf tea, and I took the cotton bark extract that so many women online swore started their labor. I drank a whole bottle and it did nothing except give me a bad taste in my mouth.
That's toxic.
It was over a couple of days. It wasn't all over. I literally had zero contractions from doing these things. Right. And so I was back to just convincing myself that the baby was going to come when he wanted to. And I was trying to bide my time. I downloaded my contraction counter here recently into like a spreadsheet so that I could delete the app. And I realized that from like 39 weeks until I had Lonnie, I was having contractions every 10 minutes for anywhere from 6 to 12 hours of every day.
Right.
So my body was doing something. It was preparing for something. But I was just starting to get worried that he was going to hang on until I had a complication.
Right. So that was literally every day, right? Is like, I'm not sick. Things are fine, but they could not be fine in a couple of hours even. So, you know, weighing that each and every day must have been hard.
Yes, definitely. So when 40 weeks came and went, and I had the induction that I didn't just not show up. I called and said, I'm not coming in for my elective. I'm electing not to be induced today. I got a call from the doctor's office that they were concerned and wanted to do a non-stress test. So I went in and did the non-stress test, and it took like an hour, over an hour, to get the good results from the stress test, because the baby was just sleeping the whole
Bad time to do one.
But it did alert me to pay more attention to his movement, and it made me nervous that I thought he may be moving less. I remember I either talked to you on the phone or text you and was like, does the baby move less in the days before labor starts? Like, is that a sign of impending labor?
Right.
And you told me no. So I was getting a little concerned that maybe his movement was less, indicating that there was, you know, less flow to him. So that was another fear thing in my mind. There was one other component to my fear. Now I was having these contractions that weren't doing anything, and my baby was moving less. I'm not going to say he was like a hypoactive baby, but it was less than what I remembered him moving.
Right.
And that blood pressure was also having these crazy spikes of like 155 over 100 at times that was making me really nervous.
Yeah.
So
I had decided that there was a couple more things that I was willing to try. I didn't know for sure what the time frame was that I was willing to try them or that I trusted that they would work.
Yeah.
I had decided in my mind there's no way to naturally induce labor.
Well, I probably didn't help with that because other than what ended up working, I don't feel like the spicy food and the this and the that really does a darn thing for people that aren't ready.
Great.
Just stresses everyone out.
Yes. Yeah. So anytime I tried anything, it was kind of a joke to me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to try this. It works for some people, but it's not going to work for me because I really thought that the people that it worked for, it was a total coincidence. And that could totally be the case in my situation as well. Who knows?
Who knows?
So after that non-stress test, the next day I was having consistent contractions and I had decided if this wasn't it, if I didn't go into labor from these contractions, that I was going to try something to stimulate more contractions, which would hopefully put me into labor. And so I decided I was going to take castor oil, which was against my, not only against my beliefs as somebody who knows that babies decide when they're going to be born, but against my beliefs as a nurse that has been in the delivery room with women that have taken castor oil. I just didn't like anything about it.
Right.
But that's what I decided I was going to do. And it worked. It either worked or clearing out my intestines helped facilitate actual labor to go really fast.
Right. Yeah. Or you were just on the verge anyway, like you kind of thought you were. I mean, you barely took any, right? Didn't you mess up the measurements and not really even think very much?
That morning, when I made my first smoothie, I decided that 2 tablespoons was 2 ounces, which makes the worst nurse ever that day. because it's not. And I essentially took like half of the small, there's some women that take 4 ounces.
I know.
And that doesn't even work. So I had taken like half of the smallest dose to induce labor. And I didn't have any cramps. Yes, I had diarrhea. It cleared me out, but it wasn't crampy. I wasn't miserable. But about 3 hours after I took it, I started having regular contractions.
Right.
And after about an hour and a half of those regular contractions, I decided it was actually working. And I think everybody else realized that it was working before I did, even. I guess I thought that maybe my contractions would peter out after a while, after the castor oil wore off. And they didn't. They just kept coming stronger and stronger.
For the record, even with inductions in the hospital, everything you had ever told me, you know, was that the labors really were pretty smooth and went pretty fast, and that you're not a person that overreacts to intensity or pain. So, you know, I know when you took the dose, what was it like, or 7 in the morning or 8 in the morning or something like that. That if you started reporting anything regular, that it was probably going to happen pretty fast, was my guess, that you didn't need much. I mean, whether, you know, how it worked, I feel like is kind of mysterious in your case, but it did. And I also think it's such a cool example of someone like deciding what they need to do and when. And that's different than someone telling you, hey, you have to drink the castor oil tonight, or right, I'll transfer your care tomorrow. This was completely in your lap. I mean, for the record, I have never attended a castor oil, one castor oil induction in 10 years. And that was back as a licensed person when I was that one to say, you have to drink it tonight. So it wasn't a choice that was even, you know, had nothing to do with anyone but you.
No. And it was just, honestly, in the moment of deciding it, it was me deciding that if I was going to be induced in the hospital, it wasn't going to be until I tried everything that I had the power of trying first.
Right.
I wasn't just to wait until something bad happened and let them take over.
Right. And that's like a very nuanced part of this, you know, induction conversation for home birth people that we don't often have, because we're better off thinking that, you know, all induction is bad. And while it is sort of like in the bigger picture, if women can't take control of their own situation, then they're left where you would have been left, you know, which is what you said. You would have had to show up there and get a pharmaceutical induction. So, you know, it's an interesting thing to have to ponder. I don't think there's many women that have been in exactly your situation, knowing all that you do, knowing what you wanted, knowing what you didn't want, but still choosing, to do a little something so that you didn't wind up, you know, having to give up that power.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was totally my, and I guess looking back, I wish that I wasn't in that place of fear. I was perfectly happy being pregnant. I wasn't uncomfortable with my pregnancy. I was uncomfortable with my body's ability to stay pregnant as long as my baby wanted to or needed to. But I also don't feel like he was, like I forced him to be born before he was ready. Mm-hmm. I feel like he was definitely ready to be born that day.
Yeah, so, I agree.
Yeah, that the castor oil definitely worked. I mean, from the time, I want to say it was between 10 and 11 that I could say my contractions were consistent.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, after 3:30. So it went fast. It went very fast with that castor oil. Did you want me to tell like the whole story?
I mean, share whatever you want to. I know we had so much lead up. We can't just like not tell a story. So sure, go for it.
So I took the 1 ounce of castor oil, and had the contractions about 3 hours later. So I decided since it did something, I would go ahead and follow up with another ounce. So the total dose for me was 2 ounces divided into 2 different doses. And then I didn't have to do anything else to facilitate contractions. Around 12:30, I started deep breathing through my contractions. So I came into my bedroom so that I wasn't making my husband or my children uncomfortable, because I wasn't uncomfortable, but I was wanting to acknowledge the contractions and, you know, visualize that they were going to do something. And I didn't want to do that with my children gawking at me. So I came into my room to listen to an audiobook, and I was doing a manicure when Marin came over. Just being in the moment, just experiencing each contraction, and hoping that it was creating changes in my body for my baby to be born. Around a little before 3 o'clock, probably about 2:45, I decided that I should go get something to eat. So I ventured back out into my house to grab a yogurt and was chatting with Marin and Valerie and my husband, and my 14-year-old son was in the kitchen as well. And my water broke. And that's when I knew that it was going to happen soon. In my past inductions, my water was broken by the doctor with all of them except for one of them. And the one whose water stayed until it broke on its own, he was born about 30 minutes after my water broke. So I knew it was going to happen pretty quick after that. Not as quick as it did, but I knew it was going to happen pretty quick. I instantly started feeling the intensity of my contractions. I got really nauseated, threw up my yogurt, had to go to the bathroom some more, and sitting on the toilet made the contractions so strong that I wanted to then slow down my labor. So I had decided to get in the bath because in my experience with this pregnancy, getting in the bath when I was having Braxton Hicks or whatever you call them, those consistent contractions that would nag at me, I would get in the bath and they would kind of calm down and they wouldn't hurt as bad. So I thought, well, I'll get in the bath for a little bit, slow my labor down, and then it'll be fine. I don't necessarily know that the bath sped up my labor, but it didn't slow down one little bit after getting in the bath. I hadn't planned on having the baby in the bathtub, but once I was there, I wasn't getting out. 'Cause it definitely didn't take away the pain, but just made the intensity of those strong, fast contractions a little more bearable. Because it was, how many times did I have contractions in the bathtub, Maren? Maybe 6, 7?
Yeah, if that. I mean, man, it's funny that you got in to slow it down, because you didn't say that, of course. I mean, you couldn't talk, but I just figured you got in to have your baby.
Oh, I need to slow this down. This is happening way too fast. To slow it down. That way I can get through it easier. So that was my thinking getting into the bath. And then after a couple of contractions in the bath, I felt a lot of pressure. So I felt inside to see if I could feel his head, and I could. And that was the point when I was like, all right, I'm not getting out. I just decided I would stay in the bath to have the baby. And then from the time I felt his head until he came, I think was 2 or 3 more contractions from that point. And when I decided I was going to see if he was ready to come out, I had just gone into like a partial squat. I was on a knee and on 1 foot and thought maybe, I'll try to push a little bit and see if he's going to move. And he just moved all the way out with the slightest little push on my part. I felt his head come out and the rest of his body just came out all on its own. He was ready to come out that fast. So we stayed in the bath for just a little bit. And when I stood up, Maren and Valerie, I think both of your jaws dropped at the size of the knot cord.
Yeah, that was, and that's a really cool photo. Is, yeah, a true knot. Just when you were holding him, just hanging down right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Huge true knot in his cord.
Yes. So I don't know why that knot existed or what its meaning was to Lonnie, but it's definitely something looking back that may have caused a complication had I been in the hospital on the monitor receiving Pitocin.
Yeah.
And his birth very well could have ended up very differently given those factors. So I don't know if that's why he was leading me to staying home so much. If that's why he was talking to me and telling me, no, I'll be fine if you just stay home and do it on my time. It went exactly how it was supposed to go. The whole experience of delivering the placenta was totally foreign to me. Maybe I should have read up on that piece a little bit more, because in all of my others, it was basically done by the doctor. I had no real part in it. But when his placenta was born, there was like no blood behind it. I did not bleed. It didn't happen.
No, you were not a bleeder, and you rocked that placenta birth too. You saw your video, right? It's awesome. It's like you had done it 5 times before the placenta birth.
I felt totally foreign to that part of birth. I guess I was so built up on delivering the baby piece of it. I just figured the placenta part was going to be nothing. And it was a new experience for me. But afterwards, all my boys came in and met their brother and participated in, the bonding with him. And it was amazing. By 7:30 that night, we were all sitting on the couch as one big happy family. And that's exactly how I envisioned it.
It's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, it was such a beautiful birth. One of the quickest birth videos that probably exists.
Yes.
But your body knows how to do it.
Yes. Very efficient. And in the moments before, it was the contractions that I had between the time of realizing where his head was and when he was born. The things that go through a mother in transition's mind is funny. But I remember thinking, this is not better than a induced labor. I remember thinking in my brain, like, this wasn't supposed to hurt this bad. But it was, you know, four contractions that I felt that way about. And then he was born and I felt on top of the world. So I will say that last piece of delivery wasn't what I expected for having a home birth. And maybe the castor oil had that component. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know what it would be like to deliver without any form of induction, but I can also venture to say, I bet I would probably be thinking the same thing as I thought this time around, that this doesn't hurt any less.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, it is what it is. I think home or hospital is still getting the baby out and, you know, whatever that means. But, man, you do it pretty fast for whatever that's worth. Maybe it's, you know, more intense. I don't know. I don't think I've had such a fast birth personally. I mean, you were laughing and smiling in your kitchen half an hour before he was out.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't until the water broke that I even really felt the contractions at all. Like I said, it was just enough for me to experience them, and I had to decide to pay attention to them.
Yeah.
They weren't nagging at me at all. And then after he was born, my blood pressure was back to its normal. You know, it doesn't have those crazy spikes. Now, I haven't been monitoring it since I've been back to work, but I would venture to say that it probably does spike at some point during my stressful night shift life.
Right. I know. Maybe you should do a little experiment while you're not pregnant just to see how that all affects you.
Definitely.
Well, thanks for sharing your story. He's so beautiful.
Yes, I am so grateful for the experience, and I'm so happy to have found you, Maren. It was is exactly what we needed.
Oh.
Our paths crossed for a reason.
Yeah, likewise. I'm always so honored to know women like you. It, you know, it changes any kind of this being a job into something so much bigger to watch someone claim your power for themselves and their baby and their family. I mean, that's truly what will change the world. So thank you for staying true to those things for yourself and walking a hard path. And I know this will inspire so many women who are up against something, right? It's always something. I mean, for most women, something. There's something there that they have to decide. Like, is this a problem? Is this a thing? Or, you know, is it not for me? And nobody can answer that. So I think having stories like this where women really show and tell how they navigated that is so important. So thank you so much. So good seeing you here. And I have to give him a kiss. He's so much bigger than when I saw him.
Yes, he is. He's a big boy.
Thanks, Lonnie. You fell asleep here at the end. How perfect. Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for watching. You can check the indiebirth.org site for new updates and podcasts. IndieBirthMidwiferyschool.org. We are enrolling for July 2019. And otherwise, thanks for listening.